This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents The Time Collector by Gwendolyn Womack. This book is read by Lauren Ezzo and Will Damron. To Kenzo, my hand is in yours. Though with my hand I grasp only a small part of the universe, with my spirit I see the whole. Helen Keller. 1. The Music Box, El Paso, Texas. Rowan took off his gloves like a man about to duel. He slid the supple black leather away one finger at a time. He had not been planning to touch anything today, but the enameled singing bird box set with pearls was proving too irresistible. He wanted to make sure the music box was what he suspected it to be. Earlier in the day, he'd flown to El Paso and rented a car to drive to Waco Tanks, the low-lying mountains in El Paso County. On the way, a strip mall antique store off the highway caught his eye, and he pulled over. Stewart wouldn't be at their meeting point for another 2 hours, and Rowan had time. As a general rule, he never missed an opportunity to visit an antique store. The more out of the way, the better. Some of his most exciting finds had been in unassuming places, such as this. The elderly shopkeeper glanced up from behind the counter when Rowan entered, and after a minute, offered a greeting. Rowan hid a smile at the man's appraisal. He was used to getting that look, being well over 6 feet, with dark hair that cut a dramatic swath to his shoulders. He always wore black, a severe choice, but he found it also helped detract from the fact that he always wore gloves. Before Rowan walked in, the man behind the counter had been squinting hard at an account ledger, tallying numbers while he ate an egg salad sandwich, but his attention was divided now that Rowan was in the room. The only sound breaking the silence was the relentless ticking from a wall of cuckoo clocks and the drone from the rusted fan on the counter. The shop owner finally got up the nerve to ask him, "Just passing through?" Rowan gave a distracted nod, his eyes surveying the showroom. Most pieces appeared to be from the late 19th and early 20th century, the majority Texan and old Americana from Mexico all the way south to Panama. Not an inch of wall or table space was wasted. A dozen well-oiled saddles were on display next to rows of vintage typewriters, assorted crystal, and ceramics riddled with chips and hairline cracks. Old bar globe oil lamps stood clustered in the corner, and antique country quilts hung on the wall like tapestries. Behind the register, a cabinet with glass doors showcased guns from the Old West. No other customer was in the store, and Rowan doubted anyone else had been in that day. The entire space felt stale and forgotten, like a shoebox full of relics no one wanted. The old man looked to be in his early 70s and ready to retire. Perhaps he would have years ago if he could afford it. Rowan's eyes took in every bauble, knowing each one held a story. They were all doorways to the past, to histories tucked away. No item was immune, no matter how small. Even the copper spoon collection for $10 contained the moments of every hand that had ever held them. The vintage costume jewelry glittering in the glass display under the register caught his eye. On top of the counter, a delicate gold box, no bigger than a woman's hand, sat like a crown on a piece of velvet. Rowan approached the box in amazement. He had no idea how it had made its way to Texas, or to the United States for that matter. The music box had to be the oldest antique in the store. He tried to contain his excitement, already deciding he had to touch it.
"That's French, I believe, and real pearls," the old man said, clearing his throat.
Rowan studied the box, knowing it was from Switzerland, not France, and that if he turned the music box's handle, an exquisite, lifelike miniature bird would pop out. He could tell by the masterful craftsmanship the musical bird box had been made by Jacques Drault and Leschaux. And not only were the pearls real, so was the gold.
"One of my finest pieces," the man nodded,
beginning to sound nervous. A handwritten price tag dangled from the dainty wind-up handle, with $1,200 scribbled in blue ballpoint pen. Next to the Civil War cavalry rifle hanging over the man's head, the music box was the highest-priced item. Rowan bent down to continue his appraisal, not quite ready to touch it yet, not with someone standing so close to him.
"What brings you to El Paso?" the old man asked.
"Rock climbing," Rowan murmured.
"Oh, you must be heading to Waco Tanks."
The man visibly relaxed now that he could peg Rowan as an out-of-town climber.
"We get all sorts of interesting folk visiting up there. You in some kind of rock band?"
"No." Rowan smiled at the man's curiosity. He didn't tell him he was in the same business as he was, antiques. Though Rowan handled one-of-a-kind rare items, and by appointment only. He had sold a Jacques Drouot musical bird box once. If his instincts were correct, this one would be worth more. The phone behind the counter gave a shrill ring. The old man excused himself to answer it. As soon as his back was turned, Rowan seized the opportunity. He would touch the box quickly and be done before the man could turn back around. What the shop owner didn't know was that he was a master psychometrist who'd been born with a rare gift. With the speed gained from a lifetime of training, Rowan brought his hands together in an elegant surabi mudra, a complex finger lock to help his mind break through the barrier. Inhaling deeply, he placed his hand on the music box, wrapped his mind around the scrim of time, and pushed past it. Vienna, 1784. Regina gasped with pleasure as the dainty mechanical bird popped out of the music box and began its slow turn with a sing-song tweet. She had heard of these new singing boxes, but had yet to see one. The handcrafted creature was no bigger than the tip of her index finger, and yet its wings flapped like a real bird. Even the iridescent feathers ruffled with life.
"What a marvelous invention," she said aloud, although she was alone in her room.
She had been in the middle of warming up for tomorrow's concert, and waiting anxiously for her music when her maid announced the court official's arrival. Regina jumped up, at first thinking her sheet music had finally come. She'd been waiting days for the sonata, but it wasn't the new composition. An official stood stiff at the door holding a personal gift from the emperor. Regina tried to mask her disappointment and gracefully gave the messenger her thanks. Tomorrow she would be playing before the emperor for the first time, and he had continued to extend the warmest welcome to her since her arrival in Vienna. She could see why Joseph II was nicknamed the Musical King. When she had unwrapped the gift, she'd found the most exquisite gold music box set with pearls. As she watched the bird complete its spin on its golden dais, she thought how tomorrow she would be the one on display as society's latest curiosity. She'd already played one concert in Vienna last month, but her second would be a grand affair and her last performance during her visit. To add to the excitement, she would be playing with Mozart. At this point, she didn't know what made her more nervous, playing for the emperor, playing with Mozart, or the fact she had yet to see a note of music. Mozart was notorious for being haphazard with his time, but she couldn't believe he was waiting until this late hour to deliver their sonata. If it had been any other man, she would have suspected his actions as sabotage, calculated to make her look the fool. But she knew that wasn't the case. He was at this very moment urgently composing their duet. Earlier this morning, his messenger had delivered the most hilarious and audacious of apologies, promising she would have the sonata today, or Mozart would deliver his slain body instead. He also wrote that when the public discovered she'd only just received the music, her fame would soar to unheard-of heights. Regina laughed at the note. Mozart was a flamboyant flirt and completely adorable. The truth was he was spread too thin. He performed more concerts than any man in the city and composed various pieces at the same time, choosing creative freedom over the security of a post. In the short weeks she'd come to know him, she'd seen his full life firsthand. Father and husband, a man busy with social engagements, billiards, his beloved pets, and music every day. One day she hoped to have such a life, inventing the rules as she went along. "I want to live in a world where music doesn't struggle to exist," he'd told her once, his eyes shining with an otherworldly light. The fact he'd agreed to compose a sonata for her at all still filled her with immense joy when she thought on it. The sun was shining on her with Mozart's attention. Even the prospect that she would barely have time to practice before playing tomorrow didn't detract from her happiness. Mozart had been the one person she'd wanted to meet during her stay. Her first week in Vienna, when she'd attended a party hosted by the educational minister, she recognized Mozart at once without introduction. The shortest man in the room with the blemished skin also possessed the most infectious laugh. He stopped talking when she entered and rushed forward.
"At last, Regina Strinasaki, Italy's virtuosa! I have been hoping our paths would cross."
Regina had heard talk of the great composer, a child prodigy, now a man. She didn't know what to expect upon meeting him, but it became apparent within minutes that life drove his genius, for never had she met someone so full of it. He had a barrage of questions for her, his mind a maze of curiosity. Soon they were laughing like old friends cloistered in the corner away from the crowded room. She was immediately struck with how he treated her as his equal. But then she was a novelty too in the public eye. She'd been paraded about from an early age and lauded as a great violinist, singer, and guitarist from the Ospedale della Pietà orphanage in Venice, the one where Vivaldi had instructed. Her talent had masked her illegitimate birth, and she'd won the hearts of Europe one concert at a time by laying hers bare on the stage. She'd spent the last several years touring Italy, France, and Germany, unheard of for a woman, and now her arrival in Vienna, at the height of her stardom, felt like a dream. By the end of the evening, before leaving the party, she gathered her courage and asked Mozart if he would compose a sonata for her to play at her last concert in Vienna.
"Of course I will," he stunned her by saying. "I'll do even better. I'll play it with you."
Now, the evening before the concert, Regina resorted to pacing the floor. Her host delivered a dinner tray of ragu, ham, and fine pies, but Regina was unable to eat a bite. The most productivity she'd achieved all day was assisting her maid in preparing her gown for tomorrow's concert, an overly decorated pink confection from Paris that ballooned with too many ruffles.
"I'll look like a wedding cake," she said, holding the heavy gown up. "A delicious cake," her maid amended with a grin.
Regina smiled without humor. She'd encountered many courtiers and admirers on her tour, but the reality was marriage would mean giving up her way of life and her music, a future she couldn't fathom. The sharp knock at the door startled her. Regina jumped up, thinking surely this must be Mozart's messenger with the music. If it wasn't, she would officially begin to panic. The door swung open, and Mozart rushed in like the gust from a storm. Regina's maid hovered behind him.
"Forgive me, I am late."
He came toward her as if they had a standing appointment.
"Do you hate me? Have I kept you waiting too long? Is that dinner?"
Regina nodded, too stunned by his presence to say anything. She tried to find her voice.
"Yes, are you hungry?"
"Famished, but I can't stay."
He sat down on the sofa, winded.
"I only wanted to hand-deliver these myself with my sincerest, sincerest of apologies, signora."
He waved the pages in his hand.
"I'm still working out my accompaniment, but never fear, it's going to be the perfect pairing."
Regina sat down beside him, her annoyance at the delay vanishing as soon as he handed her the sonata. A thrill coursed through her, and the pages itched in her hand. She wanted to be alone with the music, to pick up her violin and begin the introduction. She had little time to prepare.
"Now!"
Mozart leaned forward, his eyes alight with the passion of having just left his work table.
"You'll find I've made the violin questioning, intentionally so, just like its mistress," he added, with a teasing smile.
A bubble of laughter escaped her.
"Am I so obviously filled with questions?"
"Only of the best kind," he assured her.
"The best kind."
He picked up the bird box sitting on the nearby table to study it. But then life is a question, one we must answer every day.
Yes, yes it is.
She gave him a faint smile. Her time in Vienna was coming to an end, as well as her grand tour. At some point, she needed to decide the shape of her future. Unfortunately, she didn't have many options.
What if I do not like the answers?
Mozart hesitated at her confession.
Perhaps I could offer you some advice as a friend?
She blinked and leaned forward in encouragement.
Yes, please.
He dropped his voice to a more serious tone, measuring his words.
Do not be cautious, either in life or in music, and never stop performing.
He put the bird box down.
My sister did, and I've seen the damage a life without music can do.
You have a talent. Play gloriously, and your future husband, your children, will happily follow you to the ends of the earth. His words lit a spark in her heart. They barely knew each other from these past weeks, and yet he had assessed her hopes and fears with the precision of a true friend.
Isn't that what we all yearn for?
Mozart turned the handle on the music box, and the bird popped up. They listened to it chirp and perform its dance.
A gift from the emperor, Regina told him.
Mozart glanced up and met her eyes with a smile.
What a witty man.
The next evening, the Kärntner Tor Theater was filled to capacity. Rarely had there been such a turnout. Everyone wanted to get a glimpse at Regina Strinasaki, the current darling of Europe. Regina, along with her entourage of escorts from Italy, would be meeting the emperor after the concert. She'd spent the remainder of the previous night and all day in solitude, preparing for the performance. From what she could tell, Mozart had composed an enchanting sonata for her, though she had yet to hear how the piano would accompany her violin. In many ways, tonight would be a complete improvisation. The audience knew it too, and anticipation filled the air. In her dressing rooms, she received the news that Mozart had arrived along with his piano, a stunning beauty made by Anton Walter. The piano traveled everywhere with Mozart, carried by a group of hired men through the streets. The instrument had only this moment been delivered to the stage. After the announcement, the minutes flew. Soon Regina was waiting near the curtain with her violin, an immaculate 1718 Stradivarius. She closed her eyes and tried to concentrate on the feel of the wood in her hand. Mozart took the stage first, to boisterous applause. Regina felt like a bride about to meet the groom for the first time and prayed, yet again, for their music tonight to ring true. When she walked onto the stage, Mozart bowed and clapped. He had never looked finer in his favorite red coat. The fact he was wearing it tonight was a respectful nod to her. He took her hand, and they bowed together. The audience applauded louder, ready to see the show. Regina's eyes slid to Mozart's sheet music sitting at his piano, and she let out a gasp. The pages were blank. His piano accompaniment had not been written. Her eyes returned to his with an astonished look. He gave her a playful wink.
"Do not worry," he whispered into her ear. "I will keep up."
Soon he began to play, and Regina's panic faded as Mozart led the sonata with stunning surety. That night, she witnessed his genius, his oneness with the music, which poured from him with perfect incandescence. His piano spoke to her violin in a conversation that had only existed in his mind until this moment. Now he was sharing it with her. The crowd didn't dare to breathe as they listened. Regina's eyes met his when they reached the opening of the Allegro. They both laughed in perfect understanding and played on, unencumbered. And in that moment, she believed miracles did exist.
2. The Pocket Watch. Los Angeles, California. Millicent hoped God forgave her for telling an outright lie. "This lamp has been in my family for generations," she told the appraiser. She could see her brother, Parker, from the corner of her eye giving her a look, but she kept on. Every year, my brother and I would put a sheet over it at Halloween and tell ghost stories by the green light. Parker crossed his arms, looking ready to disagree. He'd never seen this green lamp in his life. She stepped on his foot to keep him quiet. My grandma let me keep it in my room. Another lie. The one grandmother she knew had died when she was 4, well before Parker was born. She never knew her father's mother. She never knew her father either, for that matter.
And you had no idea what this was.
The Antiques Roadshow representative looked fascinated and gave her an encouraging nod. No, just Granny's funny old lamp. Not only did Mellicent know what the lamp was, but also how old it was and who made it. Is it worth anything? She asked tentatively.
I'll say.
The roadshow representative chuckled and launched into his appraisal.
What you have here is one of the first Tiffany table lamps from the early 1900s.
He pointed out its features with the pen in his hand.
Notice the signature geometric pattern, the alternating bands of monochromatic glass segments, the bronze stand. It's in excellent condition. The last lamp like this one auctioned for...
Mellicent held her breath, waiting for the number.
$57,000.
Mellicent was too stunned to respond.
$57,000? Parker squealed. For a lamp?
The appraiser beamed at the pair of them and shook Mellicent's hand.
You have quite a reading lamp there, young lady. Congratulations,
he said, signaling it was time to move along and let the next person in line have a turn. The exhibit hall at the Los Angeles Convention Center had accumulated quite a crowd. Lines snaked all over the enormous space, with people waiting to show off their heirlooms to see how much they were worth. Mellicent grabbed Parker's hand and led him away. Her legs felt weightless, like she could run a marathon. She was holding a $57,000 lamp. If she could sell it, they wouldn't have to worry about finances for a long time. It would alleviate so much of the pressure they were facing. And she hadn't even appraised the pocket watch yet. Parker yanked his hand away when they were out of earshot.
Where did you get that thing?
Yesterday, at the flea market.
You went to Trading Post again? He asked in surprise.
No, Mellicent hesitated. A swap meet in Anaheim.
You went to Anaheim without telling me.
A twinge of regret filled her. Ever since their mother passed away, Parker worried about everything. They were more than 10 years apart in age. He was only 16. And right now, he was glaring at her like a parent.
How much did you pay for that thing?
$100? Mellicent grinned, still in disbelief that she might make a $56,900 profit. $100 had been a lot of money for her to spend. She had gotten the cash last month after finding an antique pen for $20 and selling it for $800 on eBay. It's what had given her the idea to go hunting for more antiques. I still have to get one more thing appraised, she said, handing Parker the lamp. Antiques Roadshow was visiting L.A. for the weekend, and today was her one chance.
We have to stand in line again? Seriously?
He motioned to the swelling crowd of senior citizens holding their treasures.
Look at all this crap.
He gave a nod to the man in front of them holding a bizarre porcelain giraffe. Would you watch your language? Although Mellicent couldn't help but agree, the porcelain giraffe was hideous. I'm sharing the money with you. Can you at least try and act like you're having fun? His eyes lit up.
For real?
Toward your college tuition, yes. She watched his shoulders droop in disappointment. College was still 2 years away, but Mellicent was already worried about how they could afford it. Plus the truck you were eyeing.
Get out!
His mouth dropped open. The truck he wanted was a 15-year-old Dodge Dakota Sport and cost $3,000. It wasn't anything fancy, but it could get him around town and hold his surfboard.
And the phone,
Melisande added wryly. This morning, she had been worried about paying their electricity bill, and here she was agreeing to a car and a cell phone. She let out a laugh. She hadn't felt this good in a long time. Parker hugged her.
Thank you. Thanks, Mel.
He choked up. Melisande could feel the knot in her throat and squeezed him back. She should have done this sooner, used her talent. Maybe if she had, she could have helped her mother. $57,000 could have gotten her better medical care. Maybe they could have enrolled her in some kind of experimental drug study. Maybe she would have lived. Melisande stopped, pushing that dark thought aside, but still it lingered. The truth was she had always avoided touching old things, fearful of the vivid ideas and images that came to her when she did. She would drop the object like it burned her and cross her arms protectively. It was something she had been doing all her life, until her mother, Sadie, got sick last year. The cancer had been aggressive and, in the end, untreatable. After her mother died, Melisande found herself in her mother's house, surrounded by all her things, and Melisande wanted to touch everything. Her mother's clothes, her pillow, her jewelry, all the things Sadie collected, the candles, the seashells, the wind chimes. When Melisande held the objects in her hands, images of her mother's life appeared in her mind like a poignant daydream. Her beautiful mother, young and vivacious, the quintessential California surfer girl from Venice Beach, with long blonde hair and blue-green eyes, a Beach Boys it girl who dreamed of becoming a famous actress one day. Like a story unfolding, Melisande could see her mother's memories, and how Sadie almost did achieve her dream. She'd landed the movie role of a lifetime, but then gotten pregnant with Melisande. And life got in the way, first with Melisande, and then with Parker 11 years apart, both accidental pregnancies with different fathers. No one would be able to tell by looking at them that Parker was Melisande's half-brother. Sadie had married Melisande's father young and divorced him 2 years later. Parker's father had been MIA from the start, the result of a 6-month string of dates that had led nowhere. Sadie had never talked about all her almost-never-was moments, the letdowns and the heartaches. And Melisande's heart broke for her mother when she discovered each one. But when Melisande found the old box of baby clothes in the closet, she'd held the blankets and the onesies and sensed how much her mother had loved them. Sadie wouldn't have changed a thing. Melisande's journey with her mother's possessions had woken up the ability burrowed deep inside of her. Suddenly, the odd things that happened to her growing up made sense. As a child, she'd always tried to ignore the sensations when she touched something and saw an image in her mind. She'd explain it away and suppress the encounter. Now she no longer could. Her ability was growing stronger every day the more she acknowledged it. She found out there was an official name for being able to sense the past in an object through touch. Psychometry. The final turning point had come last month when she had gone rummaging at Melrose Trading Place on her one Saturday off from work. She had picked up an old pen, a Conklin Nozak fountain pen. Before she could put it back down, she knew that the pen had belonged to the author Edgar Rice Burroughs. In her mind's eye, Burroughs was writing with the pen, and Melisande glimpsed moments of his life, like reading a biography about someone while watching him work. Burroughs had been everything from a soldier to a ranch hand to a pencil sharpener salesman before he became one of America's most prolific writers. The pen had been his favorite, the one he wrote Tarzan of the Apes with. Melisande grew up knowing the story of Tarzan, just like every kid, but she had never read anything by Edgar Rice Burroughs, didn't even know his name. And yet now she knew details about the man's life. She turned the pen over to find his initials engraved on the side. E.R.B. His first wife, Emma, whom he had 3 children with, had given him the pen as a gift. Melisande bought the pen for $20 and went home, afraid to touch it again. It was one thing to see moments from her mother's life, but this man was a stranger. The next evening, she sat at her desk, staring at the pile of bills, and was struck by the idea of selling the pen. She logged into her mother's eBay account, relieved to find it was still active. Her mother had often taken to selling odds and ends around the house on eBay to help bring in extra money. Now, more than ever, the urge gripped Mellicent to try too. Her mother's funeral and remaining hospital bills had wiped out their savings. If Mellicent didn't do something soon, she would have to sell the house. The 3-bedroom English-style cottage in Venice Beach had been in their family for 3 generations and was their only asset. It sat on a corner lot and was ringed by giant trees as though it were in a grove. Mellicent had spent her childhood climbing those trees. She tried to show Parker her secret perches when he was old enough to climb, but Parker was terrified of heights. Mellicent hoped one day, if she ever had kids, they could climb her trees too. But that day might never come. Her mother had mortgaged the equity in the house to the point where Mellicent could barely make the house payment. Trying to sell the pen on eBay was worth a shot. So she took a picture of it and posted the auction details. A rare find, the pen that wrote Tarzan of the Apes, Edgar Rice Burroughs's fountain pen, engraved with his initials. She didn't know how she could prove the claim to be true, but she decided not to worry about that detail. After mulling over the price, she started the bid at $50. By the end of the week, the bidding had climbed to $500 and sold for $825 to a pen collector in Maine. Mellicent carefully wrapped Burroughs's pen in a gift box and included a note about the historical details she knew. Then she mailed it off. That night, she took Parker out for a steak dinner in Santa Monica and told him about selling the pen. She left out the part about how she knew whose pen it was, and Parker didn't seem to care. He was more interested in his top sirloin. As Mellicent watched her brother eat the best meal they'd had in ages, her heart hurt, and she promised herself she would do everything she could to give him a better life. She took part of the pen money and waited for her next Saturday off from work to go treasure hunting. Now, when she picked up an antique, she had a very good reason to not put it down. Parker watched Mellicent pull a piece of wrapped silk from her purse. "What's the other one?" he asked, invested in their field trip if it meant getting a car and a phone. "An antique pocket watch." Mellicent tried to ignore the wave of nerves hitting her stomach while she waited in a different line. She would have to tell the truth about how she'd found this one. There might be some kind of legal questions or, at the very least, intense scrutiny, which is why she'd had the vendor at the swap meet write on the sales receipt what kind of watch he thought it was. She hadn't told the man. He was wrong.
"Did you get that in Anaheim, too?"
"No." Mellicent shook her head. "Mission Viejo."
"You went to Mission Viejo yesterday, too?"
Parker shook his head in disbelief.
"Your car is barely running."
Her old Nissan Sentra had 200,000 miles on it and was on its last legs. She kept a bottle of brake fluid in her glove compartment for the leak she couldn't afford to fix. "I went to Anaheim and Mission Viejo, that's all." That was all she could fit in one day. Depending on how much this watch was worth, she may have more places to go, antiques to find and money to make. She was on a mission now. The line moved forward. Mellicent expelled a deep breath. She was next. The appraiser spotted her and gave her a wide smile. The man was somewhere in his 40s, 2 decades younger than the last appraiser, and clearly appreciative of the lovely young woman coming toward him. Mellicent was wearing faded jeans and a gypsy-style embroidered blouse, and her long hair was knotted into an artful bun and secured by sandalwood chopsticks. The beaded choker around her neck accentuated the eclectic look.
"Hello, please step forward."
The appraiser shook her hand.
"What's your name?"
Mellicent Tilpin. Mellicent warily eyed the camera crew parked behind him and tried not to panic. How had she ended up in the line with the camera crew?
"Welcome, Mellicent," he said. "Is this your brother?"
She nodded. Parker and she shared the same sun-kissed gold hair and hazel eyes, both inherited from their mother. The only difference between the siblings, aside from the age gap, was that Parker towered several inches above her, and she was 5'9". He was the one who looked like a giraffe, awkward and not sure of himself.
"So what have you brought us today?"
Mellicent held out the pocket watch.
"Well now."
The appraiser suddenly stopped talking as he took it.
"Good heavens."
Parker shot his sister a questioning glance. The man conducted his intense appraisal without a word. When he opened up the case to look at the watch's face, Mellicent's pulse sped and she tried to remain calm. The man glanced at her over the rim of his examining glasses.
"Where on earth did you get this?"
3. The video. El Paso, Texas.
"Would you like to buy it?" the old man asked Rowan.
He had finished his phone call and turned back around to see Rowan holding the bird box. Rowan set the box down and quickly folded his fingers into a Kashyapa mudra. His hands resembled two tortoises returning to their shells. The finger lock helped him return to the present.
"I could take 5% off," the old man offered.
Rowan took a step back from the counter and expelled a short breath. He hesitated, unsure if he could speak yet, and focused all his intention on finding his voice. He had been peering into the past all his life, for as long as he could remember, and over time had developed methods for returning swiftly. It had taken him years to master.
"I'm afraid I can't afford it," Rowan answered, his voice hoarse.
10%?
"Thank you, but I still couldn't afford it."
Rowan nodded to the box.
"The last singing bird box of this quality sold for $182,000 in 2007.
The old man's eyes went round, and the pen fell out of his hand.
"This one," Rowan motioned, "is worth even more. I'm fairly certain there's an engraving on the inside indicating it was a gift."
The man looked down at the box in astonishment.
"You'll want to get it into the proper hands and have it auctioned," Rowan said, as he put back on his gloves.
"Christie's in New York would probably start the bidding at $200,000.
$200,000?
The shopkeeper swallowed, and then swallowed again.
"Regina Strinasaki. Remember that name."
Rowan took the pen on the counter and wrote Regina Strinasaki on the blank sales receipt tablet sitting beside the register.
"Why, who was she?"
the shopkeeper asked in a high voice, looking ready to faint.
"Joseph II gave this music box to her in 1784 in Vienna. She was also the violinist Mozart composed a sonata for, Sonata No. 32 in B-flat major."
He wrote that down, too. "There might be a record." He tore off the paper and offered it like a doctor holding out a prescription. The old man took the receipt and looked at Rowan with wonder, knowing he had been given the gift of a lifetime. Before he could ask Rowan more questions or thank him, Rowan left. It took Rowan a good hour, almost the whole drive to Waco Tanks, for him to disconnect from the stream of Regina Strinasaki's memories coursing through him. The pinwheel of sights, smells, and sounds from 18th-century Vienna was still circling him, from the pageantry of the clothes seen on a simple walk down the street, to the animated talk and scent of spiced coffee spilling out from the sidewalk cafes, to the music that lingered in the city's air. Regina had kept the music box for the rest of her life, until her death at 75. Her trip to Vienna and playing with Mozart was a treasured memory, and she took out the bird box during her most sentimental moments of recollection. Her imprint within the object was strong, and had offered Rowan a clear glimpse of her life. The year after Regina left Vienna, she took Mozart's advice and married a fellow musician, Johann Conrad Schlick, a talented cellist and the director of an orchestra in Gotha. Her music continued to play a large role in her life, and even after having two children, she performed recitals and composed. In the end, she achieved her dream. By the time Rowan reached Waco Tank State Park, he was able to push the bird box and its trove of memories into the back of his mind. He left his car at the campground and hiked into the park to the place he and Stuart had agreed to meet. He waited for several hours, but Stuart didn't show. Rowan called him twice. The third time, he left a voicemail. "I'm here. Let me know if you aren't coming." He hung up and stared at the fantastical rock formations on North Mountain and tried to ease his worry. Stuart was from London, and they usually rendezvoused to climb two or three times a year. Their last trip had been to Hatun Mache in Peru, and the two men weren't scheduled to meet until next month. But Stuart had called this week and left a message saying that he needed to see Rowan right away. The voicemail had been cryptic and strange, and he'd been unreachable ever since. Stuart said he wanted to meet Rowan at the spot they first climbed together. Stuart didn't specify the location, but Rowan understood. Their first spot was Waco Tanks, where they'd climbed 4 years ago. Why Stuart had relayed everything in code was a question Rowan was looking forward to getting answered. Hopefully Stuart had a good reason for standing him up. He was always traveling in some foreign country, exploring obscure locales with limited cell phone reception. Rowan would work on tracking him down when he got back home. Since he was at the park, he decided to get in a few climbs before he headed back. Waco Tanks was the bouldering mecca of Texas. The park covered 860 acres and had over 2,000 problems, what boulderers called potential climbs. Bouldering was climbing with bare hands and without rope, and the climbs were rated by a system of V1 to V17, with 17 being the hardest. Rowan had been climbing since he was a teenager, starting with V1s and working his way up, until soon he was climbing V9-plus rated problems, routes only expert boulderers could attempt. Climbing, like the hand mudras, helped him to clear his mind and find balance. It was the only time he could take off his gloves and stay grounded. Today, Rowan was about to ascend his favorite problem at the park, Terramer. It was also the hardest climb in the park, a V15. He stripped off his gloves and jacket, wearing a lightweight t-shirt and black Arc'teryx Gamma climbing pants. The pants were his favorite, a four-way stretch fabric with double weave knees. He took out his climbing shoes from his backpack and wiped them down before putting them on. Then he grabbed his chalk bag and hung it from the hook at his belt, along with a small dusting brush he used to clear leftover chalk marks and debris off the rocks. Before chalking up, he did some deep stretches to prepare. When he put his white chalked hands on the boulder, the rock was cool beneath his fingertips, but not too cold. The weather was on the warmer side, in the high 60s, a perfect day to climb for early December. A lot of climbers visited the park from November through March, but today not too many people were around. Rowan could see a group of college kids in the distance trying to climb a V5 problem. At least he would have Terramer all to himself. He started his ascent like a graceful spider, the igneous stone solid beneath his grip. His body twisted and turned as he read the rock, finding the hand and footholds with ease. His climbing shoes forced his weight to the front of his feet and made his toes curl. He turned his hips on the next sequence to stay close to the wall and set up for the next move. Soon his muscles were straining with each maneuver, and his breath began to come in shorter bursts. As he ascended, he took in all the tick marks, chalk holds, and rubber shoe scuffs from previous climbers, written like a story left behind. Rowan could feel the fierce determination of everyone who had climbed Terramer before him, and it fueled him to keep going. He climbed like a dancer, his body elegant and lean. No energy was wasted. He performed a tricky crossover arm move that ended with a two-finger pocket hold, and soon passed the crux of the climb, the hardest point, to finish the ascent. At the top of Terramer, he stared out over the park and took in the expanse. The climb had invigorated him. He only wished Stuart had made it.
"That was awesome!"
one of the kids at the V5 called over to him. Rowan acknowledged them with a salute. Then he made the down climb to the ground he'd spotted earlier. He checked his cell phone again, still no messages. He called his office to touch base with his business partner, Holly.
Hey!
Holly's voice perked up.
On your way back?
In a few hours.
You got a package today from Stuart. I dropped it off at the warehouse for you. But isn't he with you?
Rowan tried to swallow his frustration. Why had Stuart sent him a package? He didn't show.
Well, that was flaky of him.
Holly didn't have the highest opinion of Stuart. She was also Rowan's oldest friend.
I have some good news, she told him. I located Faye Young. We spoke. She's in Michigan.
A sense of relief filled him. They had been searching for Faye Young for some time now. His nonprofit corporation, the Heirloom Foundation, wanted to present Faye with a lost heirloom that had belonged to her great-grandmother. Are you scheduling a flight out? He asked her.
This evening.
Holly had been busy making these trips for the foundation, which she'd done without complaint, believing in the mission of the nonprofit as much as he did. Before she hung up, she mentioned an interesting video that she'd come across on the internet.
I thought you'd want to take a look at it. I sent you the link.
Rowan spent a few more hours climbing and then headed back to the airport. For domestic trips, he always flew private, and for this trip had chartered a light jet that sat 8. The cost was worth it if it meant he could avoid busy airports and people. Crowds made him uneasy, even with his gloves on. After the plane took off, he settled in for the 2-hour flight back to New Orleans and opened up his laptop to check email. The one from his mother made him grimace. From Dr. Jocelyn Mathis, University of Oxford.
Please come for dinner. I have some questions for you on a Bonaparte matter you might be able to resolve. M.
Rowan shook his head. She made it sound like she was next door and not across the Atlantic in Great Britain. He replied with a simple, tied up, soon. He hit send, knowing that would not please the professor. He could imagine her at her computer, with her reading glasses perched low on her nose, blinking balefully at the screen like an owl. The next email was from Holly with the promised link. He clicked on it to find recent footage from an antiques roadshow convention in Los Angeles. The subject header read, "Psychometrist finds million-dollar pocket watch with the power of her hands." Rowan leaned forward, now engaged. He launched the video to watch an attractive blonde woman standing next to an appraiser, while a tall teenage boy hovered behind her. The pair had a California beach vibe about them. The teenager was in board shorts and flip-flops and had a thick braided cuff around his wrist. All that was missing was his surfboard. The appraiser shook the woman's hand.
"What's your name?"
"Mellicent Tilpin," she said, her eyes avoiding the camera.
"Welcome, Mellicent. Is this your brother?"
He smiled, glancing to the boy, and she nodded.
"So what have you brought us today?"
The woman held out a gold pocket watch.
"Well now."
When the appraiser took it, he stopped talking. Seconds passed until he said,
"Good heavens."
He opened up the dial and peered at her over the rim of his examining glasses.
"Where on earth did you get this?"
"At a flea market," she said, crossing her arms, looking nervous.
"A flea market? How extraordinary."
The appraiser leaned down to study it closer.
"What we have here is an original pocket watch by Abraham Louis Breguet from 1790. You can see his engraved signature here on the dial. Do you know who he is?"
The woman hesitated and then shook her head no. Rowan could tell she was lying. The appraiser chuckled.
"Only the best watchmaker of all time. This is one of his first classic Grand Complication pocket watches with a tourbillon, his most precise timepiece. These watches took years to assemble."
The appraiser was talking with his hands in excitement.
"Very few are in circulation. Most are in museums. The Breguet company usually buys them back when they enter the market. The last one sold for $1.5 million.
The woman was too stunned to say anything. Then she put her hand to her heart.
"And you say you found this at a flea market?" the man pressed.
"Yes," she whispered.
Her eyes welled with tears. Her hands were shaking as she covered her mouth. Her brother put his arm around her. Rowan watched the video, riveted.
"How did you find this at a flea market?"
Someone was selling a collection of old watches, and I put my hands over them. This one felt special, and I knew...
She hesitated.
I feel things with my hands sometimes.
The appraiser didn't know what to make of that.
You're saying you felt this watch was special with your hands?
She nodded, her expression clearly showing she knew it sounded implausible.
Sometimes I pick up stuff and I can sense things. Their history.
Well, that is something, the man said, trying to make things more exciting for the cameras. You definitely found a winner. Like winning the lottery, I'd say. He handed the watch back to her.
This might be the biggest discovery we've ever had on this show. You're the one making history.
Mellicent looked at the camera, as if remembering the crew was recording her. The image froze. Rowan stared at her face, seeing the secrets in her eyes. She had just admitted she was a psychometrist to the world. It didn't seem like the appraiser understood. Rowan replayed the video three more times, each time his amazement mounting. He had found someone else like him. As he watched the clip again, he understood the woman's emotional reaction at discovering the Breguet pocket watch. Years ago, when he found his first antique worth more than $1 million, he'd experienced the same catharsis at finding something so precious to history it was worth a fortune. That was ultimately what the dollar amount signaled, the weight of an object's worth in time. Afterward, his life had changed forever. Rowan leaned back and watched the video once more. Without second-guessing his actions, he fired off an email to Holly to have their research team gather all the information they could on Mellicent Tilpin. Then he picked up the phone and called the pilot in the cockpit to see if he could reroute their flight to Los Angeles instead of New Orleans. He had to meet her.
4. The Snow Globe. Culver City, California. After finding Burroughs's pen last month, Mellicent began seriously researching psychometry, and was currently reading an excellent book on the subject titled Mastering Psychometry, written by Max Woods in the 1990s. Psychometry technically meant measuring the soul of things. Psychometrists had the ability to connect with the memory that resided within an object when they held it in their hands, even re-experience it. And a psychometrist could, by training the mind, tap into any point in history. The world was energy in motion, and every moment in time left an imprinted copy of itself, like a hologram or a recording. Just as a shell was rolled by the waves and held by the memory of the ocean, all things in the world recorded the moments that surrounded them. Information was never lost, but remained perfectly preserved, and every moment of the past lay dormant, waiting to be rediscovered. Woods even went so far as to say that psychometrists were the archaeologists of the future. Mellicent's eyebrows rose when she read that. Did a lot of people have this ability? Because she'd never heard of it before or met anyone else who did. The book went on to explain how many psychics relied on their hands to sense the unknown, intuit the future, or track down someone who was missing. They often held personal objects belonging to a person to gather information. But the actual mechanics of psychometry was different. A psychometrist could actually revisit the past. Impressions, or imprints, could be received as physical reactions, emotions, images, or sound. Usually, psychometrists favored one or two sensory channels, and each person had different levels of skill. Some psychometrists had more capability, and the most highly sensitive psychometrists could receive impressions by all four channels, to the point where, when they held an object, they became transported to a different time and place in the past altogether. It depended on the talent of the individual. Mellicent read the book's baseline questions in the Uncovering Your Talent chapter. Do your moods swing in a crowd? Do social events leave you feeling drained? Do you sometimes have trouble determining where a particular feeling is coming from? Mellicent kept reading, thinking a definite yes on all counts, Yes, she was hypersensitive, and sometimes weary after dealing with groups of people. She also did sometimes sense or think random things when she shook someone's hand or when she sat down on other people's furniture. What if furniture could talk? Well, according to this book, it did. Millicent looked down at her hands, feeling as if they belonged to a stranger. She had found an old pen, a Tiffany lamp, and a priceless pocket watch, objects she could identify simply by touch, that were worth more money than she knew what to do with. The reality was, she had a hard time accepting what had happened, that she had made the discovery by psychic touch or psychometry or whatever she should call it. The appraiser was right. It did feel like winning the lottery, only she hadn't bought a ticket. Now all she had left to do was to sell the two antiques. At the moment, the lamp was in her bedroom, and the Breguet pocket watch was hidden under a floorboard in her mother's closet. Tomorrow she had an appointment with a representative from Breguet at their store on Rodeo Drive. Maybe she would begin to believe this was all real when the money was in the bank. She glanced at the clock on the wall and grimaced. There was still an hour to go. Why she was at work today when she'd found a $1.5 million pocket watch, she didn't know. Maybe now she could quit her job and try something new. She'd been hovering in an in-between stage forever while she considered the next step in her career. Years ago, when she chose to major in fine arts in college, with a focus on sculpture, she hadn't considered how unemployable she'd be after graduation. It wasn't like businesses were lining up to hire sculptors fresh out of school. For the past 4 years, she had been working full-time managing The Trove, a high-end gift store in Culver City that sold art, collectibles, and jewelry. She crafted crystal snow globes on the side and sold them at the shop. She designed and constructed the globes by hand, and they were not the cheesy holiday-themed kind showcasing spooky pumpkins or Santas on sleds. Her globes were exquisite works of art, mounted on chunks of granite that evoked the feeling of capturing a daydream. Inside the glass balls were whimsical cityscapes and microforests and tiny lifelike sculptures. She sold, on average, one, sometimes two a month, for $200 apiece. There wasn't a huge market for ornate snow globes, but she loved making them more than anything else. It took her several months to create one, so the profit margin was ridiculously low. She debated getting out her latest globe to help pass the time. She'd been creating a tiny miniature of Edgar Rice Burroughs, sitting at his desk, pen in hand, dreaming up the story of Tarzan, with a forest behind him and a boy swinging from the vines on the trees. She'd started the design the day after she found Burroughs's pen, feeling compelled to capture the image in her mind. She was about to get it out when the door jingled and a customer walked in. "Welcome," died on her lips when she saw him. Millicent didn't know what struck her first, the fact that he was dressed all in black or his raven-like hair. Charisma radiated from him. When his eyes met hers, they landed on her with such concentrated force, she held her breath. He had a look on his face like he knew her and had come to speak with her. She said, "Good evening," and waited for him to say something in return. He only gave her a polite nod and turned away to browse, keeping his hands in his pockets. She sat there, openly staring at him, more than intrigued. Musician was her first thought. Or an actor. The man was riveting. Maybe he was an athlete. He looked athletic and was somewhere in his early 30s. He had a self-contained air about him that offset his compelling looks, an intensity that dialed him back from the world and made her second-guess his profession altogether. Whatever he was, he looked out of place. "Let me know if you'd like to see anything," she finally offered. She looked down at her closed book, wondering if she should open it again and pretend to read. She glanced up at him from the corner of her lashes as he toured the space. He strolled past the iron wind sculptures from Spain, the batik bags from Indonesia, and lingered over a coral dragon from China she had showcased on a stand. The dragon was one of the stars of the shop, next to the